Welcome to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California from Monday, October 13th, 2014. Thanks everyone for joining us here tonight in San Francisco. I'm John Zipperer, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for Week to Week. On today's program, we are going to look at some of the propositions and people on today on the fall ballot. We'll follow the money in the election, look at the legislative revolution occurring around the sharing economy, and check the rumblings on the national political scene, as well as a few other related topics. We've assembled a top-flight team of panelists who will take us through these issues. As usual, any opinions expressed are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end there. Joe Garofoli is a political reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. Next to him is Molly Riley, deputy politics editor for the Huffington Post. And next to me is Chuck Nevius, C.W. Nevius, for those of you who follow his column in the San Francisco Chronicle. You can find all of them on Twitter. I heartily recommend you follow them. And there are question cards spread throughout the room. Please write down and submit your questions. I will do my best to get as many asked as possible during this program. Now on to our roundtable. The first topic, the fall ballot. In fact, in preparation for tonight, I filled out my ballot this afternoon. And it was an incredibly long ballot with more propositions, I think, than I've ever voted on here. So let's talk about some of the more interesting, the more important, perhaps the more vexing ones on there. And maybe let's start on the statewide level. Joe, what propositions are you seeing as
well,
particularly
noteworthy? Well, Prop 1 and 2 are very important for the state. This is Jerry Brown has come out of hiding to actually campaign. He's not doing any campaigning on his own behalf, but he is campaigning on Prop 1 and 2.
Yeah.
He has gotten something that's very rare in California, is getting some bipartisan support on this. I believe the chamber and labor groups are backing this. This water bond for water issues, and Prop 2 would create a rainy day fund to kind of take care of California's boom and bust cycle, would kind of give us a little cushion there. And he's gotten a ton of contributions from big name tech donors. He's gotten Sean Parker, who, you know, from Facebook and Napster fame, and he's given $1 million to this. So he's campaigning hard on this, and that's going to be a very important statewide ballot.
Molly, Prop 2 is the budget stabilization one, am I right?
Rainy Day Fund.
I mean, that's kind of a legacy issue for him, isn't it? He spent most of his first term digging the state out of a financial gap. Do you think it's very important, not just for what he wants done, but, I mean, kind of his legacy to get that passed?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's seen a lot of support from, like what Joe said, Sean Parker, who is a tech person. He doesn't really have a lot of interest in, you know, that sort of stuff, but it's an important issue to Jerry Brown, and if you want to get on Jerry Brown's good side, a really good way to do that is to back these issues, Prop 1 and Prop 2.
It's down the road,
yeah.
Somebody be knocking on the
exactly.
door and saying,
hey, pay off.
Remember when I supported that?
Might be a good thing, yeah. That's right. So I think that's a good example of someone who's not worried about his reelection, then you can work on a legacy project. I mean, there's nothing sexy about a rainy day fund, but he's in a position where he can advance something like that. He knows it's a good idea. He knows it makes a lot of sense for the state. And yet, if this were a tight, tight election, they'd be battling tooth and nail about some kind of a controversy of some kind. This is what you get when you get someone who's a popular governor in his second term, feels like he can move the needle.
Molly, you were speaking earlier, before we came out here, about Proposition 47. Mm-hmm. Explain what that is and why you find it noteworthy.
So Proposition 47 would reduce penalties for a lot of minor crimes, things like shoplifting small amounts, drug possession, forgery, bad checks, things like that. And this, according to studies that have been done, could reduce the prison population in California by 20%. So that's a really significant amount, especially, you know, that's an issue that Jerry Brown's also made one of his focal points in his time in office, is reducing the prison population. And it can cost up to $60,000 a year per inmate to house someone in prison. So that's a huge amount of money that the state would be getting back. And one of the more interesting things about this proposition is it would reinvest a lot of that money into programs like substance abuse treatment, mental health, therapy, truancy programs in schools. So it would be giving back to the community and really helping not just get people out of prison, but prevent people from going to prison in the first place.
When Molly said this, you know, it's just a great issue. It's a really fascinating bill. Just to be clear, we're talking about a policeman encountering someone who's shooting heroin. He would not, that would not be a felony. That would be a misdemeanor. They're talking about keeping those people out of prison because, in a lot of cases, they're finding you're getting nowhere with that. But the really interesting thing is the people who are supporting it include Rand Paul, Ed Meese, a lot of extremely conservative libertarian groups find this to be a really compelling argument. So it's got, it's not even across the board, but it's got both poles pulling for this thing, and it'll be fascinating to see what the effect is with it.
Has there been polling on it? Do we know how it's
polling strong, and there's virtually no opposition
to it. There's hardly anyone opposing it. It's one of those things. Its time has come, and I would never have guessed to hear that. Once George Gascoigne is one of the people who started proposing this, and I thought, oh boy, he's walking into it. And the support has come from all different parts. And one of the things that Rand Paul got cheered for at Berkeley was saying we're going to decriminalize hard drugs.
Two props that do have a lot of opposition in the state, proposition we'll call it, are 45 and 46. And these involve, actually I wrote these down somewhere. Let's see. Prop 45 has to do with insurance premium hikes. I'm not sure that one is as well understood as Prop 46, which involves medical malpractice and they threw in the sweetener of drug testing doctors.
45 would allow the state insurance commissioner to review health insurance rate increases, just like he can do for car insurance increases. Not surprisingly, the health insurance companies are not too happy about this.
They love it, don't they?
Yeah, Kaiser has written a check for about $15 million against it. All of the major health insurers have raised about $40 million against it because they said, you know, we don't want this bureaucracy, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the guy kind of already does this job. The state insurance commissioner, Dave Jones, already can do this with other types of insurance. So that's going to be a big battle. And I think that is trending, yes, I believe, on this point. The polls are saying that.
It must be because the claims are getting more and more outrageous. You know,
right.
Your medical bills will go through the roof. It'll be unbelievable. So they must feel that they've got to make some desperate change. But that's it. Obviously, health care reform is going to be a huge thing no matter where you go. And that's one example of how we might.
Don't you want to be an actor in one of those prop commercials? But I wonder if they list those as their... Like
in their
resumes.
I was the
storekeeper in the Prop 46 ad.
The angry storekeeper.
The angry storekeeper.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the local propositions. And one that is actually on both San Francisco's ballot and in Berkeley. Anyone here from Berkeley?
That's okay. That's all right.
We're here to support you. Is a soda tax, the sugary beverage tax. Chuck, talk a bit about that. And
you said to get ready for this, you fill out your ballot. I drank a quart of Mountain Dew. So.
It cost you $75.
And that cost is going to go way, way up. I'm going to need some help from the panel because this is a tough one. The soda companies have spent, the beverage industry has spent, what,
$7
million?
$7 million.
$7 million on a San Francisco proposition. So my inner progressive says, I hate that. I hate that they're trying to buy this thing. But their argument is, what is this, the nanny state? You're going to tell people should know that they shouldn't drink sugary beverages. We don't have to tax them to make them understand they shouldn't be doing that. Well, people are still drinking sugary beverages. Will they keep doing it after there was a tax? So I feel very strongly both ways, and I'll be fascinated to hear how my panel members convince me one way or the other.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting issue to look at here, especially in the Bay Area, and seeing how it'll play out differently in Berkeley versus San Francisco. San Francisco, it requires three quarters,
two-thirds,
right?
Two-thirds, yeah.
Oh, two-thirds. Okay.
It's
harder to pass here. In Berkeley, you know, it's kind of being looked at, if it can't pass in Berkeley, where can it pass?
No offense.
Yeah.
No offense.
And I've gotten so many phone calls about this. I think this is the thing that I've gotten the most phone calls. and mailers about is this issue, which is really interesting.
And it's and it is, as you say, the soda companies say if you know if they can make a stand here, if you can't pass this in San Francisco and Berkeley, then it'll send a message to the rest of the country not to do this. But it's like a sin tax. We had a story the other day in the Chronicle where in Mexico they've instituted something like this about a year ago and has decreased the use of soda and because it costs more. And it has increased the consumption of other beverages like sparkling water and such. And just like all kinds of sin taxes do decrease the use, except I guess alcohol, but in cigarettes, it certainly contributed to the decreased use of cigarettes. The challenge is when you pitch it as well, it's going to raise money along with decreasing use. You kind of eat in your own seed corn after a while, because if people are doing that activity that you're paying more sin tax for, then you don't get as many sin taxes.
I always think that when you go to the food trucks and they say, would you like to have a Mexican Coke? And you say, what's the difference with Mexican Coke? It has a lot more sugar in it. It's like
I always go for that.
Sounds good to me. Yeah.
It's delicious.
Yeah.
Now, we have a couple topics in San Francisco, at least, where there are dueling propositions. So it's like you get to vote twice on something you didn't want to vote on in the first place. One of them is has to do with Muni funding of the public transportation thing. And this actually sparked quite a spat, if you will, between some of the supervisors and Mayor Lee. Chuck, can you tell us about propositions A and B?
Well, Muni is going to be an issue, obviously, in San Francisco. We could have an election on this every election. That's just about all there is to it. And one of the little things that happens that is kind of it happens kind of in the dark is very often the Muni funds are sort of a piggy bank for other programs. And we end up taking things from Muni because we'll fix it down the road. And, of course, what happens is that the buses start to have problems and then the on-time rate changes and so forth. Scott Weiner is very involved in this. He's very interested in this. He is a true believer, and he goes full out on everything. And eventually he always seems to run into opposition.
Supervisor Scott Weiner. He's also behind the soda tax.
He is a legislative machine. Nobody writes more legislation than Scott Weiner. Sometimes he's a little tin ear. You know, sometimes he doesn't really have it. But this will be fascinating just because Muni is the system you love to complain about, and yet so many people depend on it all the time. So are you willing to fund it if you're depending on it, or are you just so mad at him that you won't do it? So it's going to be fascinating.
Joe, any thoughts on...
And Sean Parker, the tech guy, has put a couple hundred thousand dollars behind one of these measures. And it's not, you know, what's the connection between, you know, tech entrepreneur and this? And it's because he's a guy who owns a business in the city. He's a resident of the city. And like a lot of the new technorati that are moving here, they're like, what the hell's up with Muni? How come it doesn't work? You know, I came from New York and the subways work. I came from D.C. and the subway works. I came from Boston and the subway works. How come it doesn't work here? So that's, I think it's kind of a frustration with those guys. It's like, let's see if we can make it work and we'll throw some money at it.
And I think the tech people are getting a lot of heat in San Francisco, and they want to have something to put on the wall and say, well, we did give money to the schools. We did give money to Muni. We did try to improve these things. And don't forget we have those great Google buses. Oh, wait, we don't want to talk about that. Never mind. That wasn't such a good thing. Never mind.
Another dueling proposition or dueling topic or other propositions are Prop 8 and Prop I. And this has to do with possible artificial turf on part of Golden Gate Park. And I'm just going to guess, if you have a viewpoint on this, you have a vehement viewpoint on this. From everything I've read, you're really for it or you really want to tar and feather me.
Just to set it up, I mean... The multitude of times that we've talked about a turf war, this really is a turf war. We can actually say that. This really is a turf war. So the idea is that, and you'll probably hear my bias as we go here, but the idea is that the fields at Golden Gate Park out by the Beach Chalet are, there's gopher holes, they're difficult to maintain, there are hundreds of soccer games that take place all the time with kids, adults, people from all over the neighborhood. So what they want to do is put in the latest artificial turf field, which is artificial grass, but it also has ground up, very small, just little dots of ground up rubber from used tires. And I know that very well because my daughter played hundreds of games on those fields, and whenever she took off her socks, we had little black dots all over the house. But the question is that, in fact, safe? And it's literally being used all over the United States. There are thousands, Ohio State, Penn State, Seattle Seahawks, I mean, all teams all over America at the top highest level are using these fields. But there is a concern that maybe there's some kind of a chemical that resides in the tires that might be, say, cancer-causing. And just this week, and the opponents of the field at Beach Chalet turned cartwheels, NBC News did a feature saying we should be looking at this, we should check this out, we should see. The conclusion that they came to was, we don't really know, so let's see what's going on. But it only makes the entire issue more fraught, and that's why we have two ruling issues. So that sets it up. Now you can tell them. You can tell them what you really think. I don't know. It's a neighborhood issue, yeah. Which is so San Francisco. It's been battled. They've taken it to the Board of Supervisors twice. They've appealed it to the courts. They've lost the appeal to the courts. They've appealed the appeal. They lost that appeal. They've gone to the Coastal Commission. They've come back to the Board of Supervisors. They've had three votes to the Board of Supervisors. And I asked someone the other day, you know, if you lose this, I guess that'll be the end of it. And they said, oh, no, we're going to court right away. So, it's not really going to happen anytime soon, but that's the idea.
Okay. A couple quick questions from the audience regarding propositions before we go on to the people on the ballots. First question regards Proposition 47. That was about the changing the definitions of certain crimes. If they don't incarcerate offenders, is there a fine or some other consequence? So we're talking reduced penalties, am I right?
It's still a misdemeanor. So you will likely face a fine, maybe community service, but there's just no incarceration involved at that point.
And the fact is the majority of these cases are not being treated as felonies anyhow. They're almost always being pled down. It's taking more court time, and it's really getting you to the same place without all the extra court time and lawyers and so forth. So that's their argument.
Okay. Next question. How is Prop 2 being funded? So maybe who are some of the big funders behind Prop 2? Joe, do you know?
Well, Prop 2 is the governor's thing. This is, again, tech money, couple of big donors, the labor unions are big behind it. Jerry Brown, his own campaign, I mean, if you donate your money to Jerry Brown, he's taking that money and donating it to Prop 1, so because he's not campaigning. So those are the major donors. Again, it's largely the traditional Democratic caucus, major unions, and these large tech donors. Reed Hastings, I think, from Netflix also kicked in like $250,000 to it also.
Actually, someone just asked, how about Prop, I believe it's L, which regards changing the city's policy toward kind of trying to, basically it's motorists versus cyclists, if you want to put it really simply. Any thoughts on that? I guess it would be changing the way the city is implementing various traffic and other roadway things from a bias of trying to encourage people to travel other than by car, which I guess is the current...
We don't want to touch that one, John.
Let's talk
well,
about
it's
chalet.
Again, San Francisco, cyclists and motorists, and we'll throw in pedestrians too. It's just a group of true believers, and the cyclists are growing. The number of cyclists that go down Market Street every day is, I believe, 20,000. They have a counter right there on at like 7th and Market. The city has a counter, and it keeps a total. And the numbers are astonishing. The only thing is, then someone says, gee, we've got all these people on Market Street. Maybe we should move them down to Mission Street and create a different lane, and they don't want any part of it. The cyclists are, this is our street. We're taking it. We finally got this far. Don't tell us anything different. And the motorists say they don't stop at stop signs. They, they're crazy, and the pedestrians walk out in front of everybody, so... Welcome to San Francisco.
This is also a reflection of a generational thing, too. Millennials, the millennial generation is, many folks don't see the need to have a car. You know, they can get by on their bike and Uber and public transportation. And so we're going to probably see more and more of these type of things.
Yep. Okay. I don't own a car. I don't know very many people who own a car that are my age. I'm terrified of riding a bike in the city. I live right on the Panhandle, which is the end of the Wiggle line. But yeah, it's a very popular way to get around. And with Muni being so fraught with problems and delays all the time, more and more people are opting for bikes.
You know, car companies are actually very worried about the millennials because all the traditional sales pitches and so forth aren't working. First of all, they're not interested in a car, and your brand new sexy thing with the fins and the sunroof is, who cares?
Yeah, and with more people living in cities, that's only going to continue.
The urban movement, that's exactly right. Yeah, I think that's really true.
Okay,
but I'm scared to ride my bike.
You're right, Chuck. You are in the firing line. Someone says for you, in a green city, how can you support putting a commercial sports arena in Golden Gate Park? Don't say it's for the gopher holes, since a wire mesh under the grass will stop this. As for increasing the usage of the land, that's fine for a factory or commercial lot, not for a park. So, slap, slap.
Oh, gosh. Well, I knew it would happen. All I would say is it's being used dramatically now, and I think it would be a much better use of it if you'd like to think of a green city. There's far less watering, there's far less maintenance. There are objections, I know, to the lights. That's going to be part of it. But I feel like they've done an awful lot of study to mitigate that. I don't know. I just think it's a good idea.
Well, okay, we'll take Chuck off the hot seat here. And let's talk about some of the people on this ballot. Of course, for governor, this is a foregone conclusion, right? Governor Brown is ahead by double digits. Molly, is Republican Neel Kashkari, what's he doing to try to make this a closer race, or at least keep people awake?
Just before we got in here, we watched his new ad that came out today, which depicted a child drowning and Neel Kashkari pulling the child out of the water to represent Jerry Brown's silence on teacher tenure and the Vergara ruling. So he's really got a flair for the dramatic right now. He doesn't have very much money. He's about $600,000 left to campaign with. You know, he's just kind of throwing some Hail Marys here.
When you're going to the kid drowning,
yeah,
that's a mark. That's a low water mark, if you will.
The gas giveaway a couple weeks ago.
Turns out he's homeless. I didn't know that.
he did that
thing with the homeless where he was applying for a job. If there's ever a definition of somebody throwing all the spaghetti at the wall, this is definitely the guy.
Molly, you're right. I think this is even lower than the giving away gasoline to come to a campaign event. I mean, free gas, like fill up your car, and, mm-hmm. and you know, it's like
in LA too.
In LA, I mean, and still people didn't show up.
Okay, well, someone who has an even better chance of re-election than Jerry Brown is Nancy Pelosi. So let's not even talk about her. But what are some of the other interesting U.S. House races in California? How many here are in Mike Honda's district? Several people.
Give him your stats.
How many people know who Mike Honda is?
He makes those terrific cars.
The millennials aren't buying.
They're not buying.
He's engaged in a battle right now. That, you know, one set of polls that came out today from his opponent Ro Khanna's campaign said that they're even at 38-38. With 21 undecided, and you said, Molly, you said you saw another one,
yes,
another
poll. Honda's campaign also put out a poll today that was, I think he had a 15-point lead in that poll with 31% undecided. So that's a huge margin of voters.
Yeah, so at this point, yeah. There's been a lot of publicity around the campaign, a lot of people talking about it. It's been high volume down in the South Bay, and this is a classic example of like two guys who really, there's not a lot of daylight between them on their positions. You are purely voting on an image, and is you have on one hand you have Mike Honda, a guy who has an exemplary life. He was in a Japanese internment camp when he was younger. He has been in the House for a couple dozen years. He is a strong union vote, super progressive on everything, but he's 74, 75 years old. He's going up against the guy who's 39 years old. He was a trade representative for the Obama administration. He represents the New Valley. You know, he has a lot of Mark Andreessen and I think other high-tech folks support him. So you're voting down there almost like, which way is the valley going to go? Is it going to go to continue to be the represented by Mike Honda, which is kind of the valley that was, or is it going to be this guy Ro Khanna, who is representing some kind of the future? Or does that even matter at all? Because they're both going to be probably voting the same way on a lot of stuff.
When Ro Khanna, the best he can come up with is, and I think he's probably a fine candidate, but the best, what he comes up with is he's been there too long. That's basically his argument. And that tells you that, because you know if there was something else they could really make a dividing point, they'd do it. They don't have it. He's been there too long. Sometimes that works. And sometimes people say, we like that he's been there a long time. He's effective.
It worked for Pete Stark, but Pete Stark was kind of absentee. He was mailing it in for years.
Hadn't been in presence in his district. That's exactly
right.
Exactly.
But Honda's, you know, been more of an active participant in our democracy.
I would just say, in terms of polls, I have two words for you, Mitt Romney. I mean, they were convinced they were going to win this thing.
Right.
And polls, I think, have really taken a turn. And I think we're kind of scratching to get accurate data.
Okay. Well, let's move on to another topic, though certainly related, and that is who's funding this election, who's funding the main propositions, and which propositions are getting the big money, and, of course, which candidates. So, Joe, who are the big givers in California?
The big givers, as I said earlier, the healthcare industry on 45 has given it, you know, $40 million because they don't want someone else deciding who they don't want the person who's assigned to or could be assigned to determining whether their rates are too high. So they're pouring a ton of money in there. And we're seeing this new class of donor, this tech giver, a few key guys giving some, wading into areas that have nothing really to do with tech for a variety of reasons. Number one reason is, from what they're telling me, is that they trust Jerry Brown. They trust his kind of paddle left, paddle right philosophy. They think he's pragmatic. He's with the help of the legislature, kind of study the state's finances. There's still, you know, billions of dollars of pension issues out there, but they like the first few steps that he's done, so there's some trust in him, and that's saying a lot. And they think he's going to win, so they're backing this the 1 and 2. And so there's so these guys are weighing in now too. And then, of course, the soda tax industry, the soda industry.
I think one of the things that's happening with tech is, it is easy to think of yourself. I mean, you remember the line, I'm the smartest guy in the room, any room. You know, I know everything about everything. And the tech guys, I think, you know, it may be a cliche, but I think they kind of had that feeling. We'll get this straightened out. We'll get Muni straightened out. We'll get these schools straightened out. And politics turns out to be a little trickier than they thought. And we mentioned in the previous meeting this ALEX, American Legislative Exchange Council. So they had some pretty heavy hitters, Google and Yelp, and those guys were right behind this thing. They were donating to it. And they all had their reasons. Yelp was hoping that they would help make it more difficult for people to sue about negative reviews. Okay, so that helps Yelp. Yelp likes that. But they also, all of a sudden, by supporting that, they get caught up in Stand Your Ground, which is the law where you can be armed and you can actually shoot someone if you feel threatened. And that may not have been where they wanted to be. And all of a sudden, they started thinking, wait a minute here. We're getting a little too far off on the end of the diving board. So they've pulled their support. But I think they're finding it a real education, that politics and legislation is a lot more complicated than you think it is. And you're successful, you've got money, and that's great. But you have to find a way to make sure you know what you're really supporting.
And they feel they're kind of trapped because especially these new companies like Uber and Lyft and Airbnb, they're like, well, you know, we're disruptors. We want to, you know, we don't want to deal with any rules. But then, you know, when government comes in and says, hey, you know, we want to, you got to be regulated. Well, they're like, well, I guess we have to arm politically. And so over the last year or so, the last couple of years, they've invested more in political operations. They've started contributing more to campaigns. They started creating a D.C. presence, Sacramento presence, and because they have to get in the game. And they're finding, you know, you can be disruptive in the economy, but you still have to play the old school check-writing game of politics.
And you can track Uber across the country. Every city they go into, who do they run smack into? The taxi cabs, every single time. And my son works in D.C. at a public policy firm. I don't really understand what he does, but it's very important, I know. But a lot of people from his firm have been hired by Uber and by Lyft because they need the politics of it, because they're going to have to fight this battle every time they move in. And it's kind of bare knuckles, so it's not going to be an easy thing, but they've got to get involved in that.
Well, let's go a little bit more into that, because the whole sharing economy, Airbnb, VRBO, Lyft, Uber, It's, like you said, it's being fought across the country on a very local level, sometimes on a state level, how to regulate these disruptive businesses. Here in San Francisco, the Board of Supervisors has come up with a plan or legislation to legalize and regulate the home sharing, the Airbnb, and Airbnb is playing along, really. I mean, Molly, I mean, are we seeing a metro? Are cities starting to catch up now with some of the technology?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Airbnb ruling that just came out this week basically decided that there's a rule in San Francisco that you can't do short-term rentals, so 30 days or less are illegal. It wasn't really enforced, but that's, you know, exactly what Airbnb's business is, and also places like VRBO and HomeAway and other startups that do the same sort of service. So it's a big win for Airbnb that they can now, I think it's if you live in your home for 270 days a year, so your rental's only on the market for about 90 days a year, then you can lend it out on Airbnb. So that's sort of protecting the housing market here in San Francisco so people don't buy up a bunch of houses and just have them be Airbnbs. And I think the homeowner has to sign on to insurance now as well. That's part of it.
And pay a hotel tax.
Yes.
Or Airbnb has to pay hotel tax, which is a big deal too.
Right. So that really fits in with the trend of, you know, how these companies are moving. They started up as these middlemen companies. You know, they consider themselves marketplaces, not employers necessarily. But they're acting more and more like actual businesses. So they're going to have to start, you know, facing the facts of working with government, working with regulation.
I feel like they're all these companies are sort of being developed on the fly. I mean, Uber was gonna say, we're not a transportation company. We're just putting people together. What they do after that, therefore, we have no responsibility. If the car crashes and there's injuries, that's going to be up to the guy driving. Well, that didn't fly, so we're going to have to change that. So now they're doing that. Airbnb was like, oh, these are private citizens. Well, we want hotel tax. We want a limit to 90 days. It can't be, you can't buy it. So we're developing this stuff as we go. And in a lot of ways, it's disruptive and it's great. But there are going to be some bumps along the road. And we're already seeing them. The hammer attack by the Uber driver.
That was in town?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was here in San Francisco. And the guy who got attacked, it was a dispute over driver took a wrong turn and they started fighting and the driver responded by hitting this guy with a hammer and he's very seriously injured. I saw the photos. His eye is completely swollen. He might not be able to see out of it again. And so Uber is kind of like, well, you know, we do background checks. Like, this guy didn't have a criminal record at all. So not our problem, but the customer says he's going to sue. And it actually took Uber, I think, about a week for them to refund his fare, and that fare included, this is the crazy part, the fare included $1 fee for a safe driver check. So to add insult to injury, quite literally. So Uber has also got a lot of PR problems that they've got to address, too.
Sure.
That's what I was saying. Yeah.
I asked our audience this at a previous program. I was surprised at how many people have used these services, so let me ask again. How many of you have used either any of these home sharing or car sharing programs? That's quite a few, yeah.
Chuck, I think you recently had an experience with your Airbnb
experience.
Joe told
me to tell this story. It is, we have two or three times used Airbnb, and we rented a vacation place up at Stinson for a week, up at Stinson Beach. And we were there for a night, and then on the second night, our daughter, our college-age daughter, came up to stay a couple nights. And we're showing her around the place, and isn't this nice, and so forth. And she said, yeah, it is. You realize there's a security camera in the kitchen. And I said, what? And it was up on top of the counter, and the light was on. So you can write the guy. So I wrote him, and I said, is there a security camera? And, you know, because he was very big on you. You're not bringing your dog, are you? You can't have a dog here. We can't have parties. You know, we don't want parties here. So I wrote him, and I said, what's going on? And he said, there is a camera, but actually it's tied to the security system, and the security system isn't on, so I wouldn't worry about it at all. And I flashed back on the night before, about 1 in the morning when I got thirsty and got up to get a glass of orange juice, probably not wearing as many clothes as I would have if I'd known there was a security camera. So I put a bag over it. I just took a paper bag and put it over the top of it. You know, and the point we were trying to make is we were just talking, Wired magazine did a story called How America Learned to Trust Strangers, meaning all the shared economy. But the problem with that is they really are strangers. I mean, you don't know who they are. You don't know if they're nuts. You don't know if they're got a hidden camera or what they're doing. So there's some shaking out to do. And maybe it's just that I'm not a millennial. Maybe that's the problem.
No, see, I'm very comfortable going to someone else's house in Airbnb, but I don't want anybody in my house.
Yeah.
That's exactly.
Trust is a one-way street in my book.
Yeah. I think that's good.
And I think the other side of that, too, is there's a lot of labor issues at play with all of these sort of middleman apps. It's kind of known as the 1099 economy, where it's referring to the 1099 tax form. So these are contract workers. The Uber always touts that they have students working for them as a side job and teachers who drive in the summer. But a lot of these drivers are doing this full time, and Uber treats them like employees in a lot of respects, but they're not paying them like employees and they're not giving them benefits with the same protections. So that's definitely something that's going to need to be addressed too.
And how about the Uber drivers that were tasked to go out and ride in Lyft? Did you see that story? They were supposed to take a ride in a Lyft car and say, how do you like working for Lyft? And the guy would say, well, you know, it's all right. So if you ever think of working for Uber? And they actually had a script that they would go through and try to flip these guys so that they would be Uber drivers for two reasons. One, to get more Uber drivers, and two, to get fewer Lyft drivers. So it's pretty bare knuckles.
There's all kinds of bonuses, $500 bonuses, come drive for Lyft, come drive for Uber. And it's really a recruiting war. And the companies do feel that if they're major impediments to recruiting them, in other words, if you have to do severe background checks, if you have to do this, if you have to inspect the cars a lot more than are required now, they're not going to be able to get the numbers they need to be able to penetrate a market and have like an Uber there in 3 minutes and Lyft there in 3 minutes. So it's really an intensified thing. I was at an event a couple weeks ago, and I heard the Uber CEO said that they now believe that they can go into a city that has 50,000 people and provide service there that is, you know, comparable to a cab service, which is amazing. You know, it's one thing here in San Francisco, we have a lot of people who can work part-time, but if you're in a city of 50,000 people, that's a little bigger than Walnut Creek and Concord, somewhere in between there. And that's pretty amazing.
And I'll probably get back on the hot seat here, but let's also make it clear, the taxi people brought this on themselves.
Right.
You know, they did not do a good job. They wouldn't go out to the sunset. They camped at the big hotels and tried to get a fare to the airport. And, you know, Uber, one of the good ideas that they had is, people say that I live out on 48th Avenue, I call three taxis and I take the one that comes first. So the other two guys drive out there for nothing. Well, Uber says, if you call us, if you don't take our car, you're getting charged. And that's good for the passenger and it's good for the driver. It makes certain that you're going to show up. So taxis, talk about a learning curve. Taxis had a much bigger learning curve, and they're still slow to the
market. They deserve to be disrupted in that way.
Yeah.
And plus on Uber and Lyft, you can see your car coming.
Right.
Yeah. You can never see the cab coming. Is it coming? Where's the cab? Is it coming? Oh, yeah, I think I'll be there pretty soon. It's what the hell's that?
You call the dispatcher and he yells at you.
Yeah, exactly. Like Louis De Palma's in the other one.
Yeah, and you get in your Uber and you have water. You know, they've got a cell phone charger for you.
And
so
you get a fist bump, too.
Yes, exactly. So it's providing a service that really was needed here. I haven't taken a taxi cab in over a year here, I would say.
That's it.
My favorite headline was from ValleyWag, which was something to the effect of, people keep getting in strangers' cars thinking they're Ubers because I'll be in the blue Prius. Look there. Well, let's talk about the U.S. Supreme Court, which came down with, they came down with a ruling. They came down with a non-ruling recently. They passed on hearing from a handful of states that were resisting legalization of same-sex marriage. They were looking to protect their bans on same-sex marriage, but those bans have been struck down by various lower-level courts. So the Supreme Court says we're not hearing it, which means the lower court ruling stand. Chuck, did the Supreme Court take the easy way out, or were they, by not taking it, are they saying this is settled?
Yeah, I think they're taking the easy way out, and it heads towards settlement. We were talking earlier. I mean, the speed with which same-sex marriage has moved in the United States has been dramatic. I think we calculated 35 states now, and that's just unheard of. And this was five this time, and they declined to take it. I don't know if you know this. I'm an esteemed Supreme Court scholar. I don't know if I ever mentioned that to you. Yeah.
I'll put that in your
bio next time. Actually, yeah. I study in my spare time on this. But my thinking is that if they get to the point where it's almost a foregone conclusion when they take it, it won't be earth-shaking. And even at this point, because five cases, surely you could have found one that would have balanced on a point of law that you could have made a decision. And I think they just don't want to be too far out ahead of the parade here. But eventually, it's going to catch up. And when they do it, it'll be no big deal. It's coming. We know it's coming. It's just a matter of time. And again, the speed at which this has transformed America is amazing.
Molly, were you surprised by this non-decision?
I did think that they would take it. I really did. But, you know, this was definitely seen as a win by marriage equality supporters. And I think the day after the ruling, 60% of Americans lived in states with marriage equality. And that's only increased in the last week. I think we were trying to count it out today, and it's like five in the last week after this. So it really is, talk about a domino effect. But it's just amazing to see how much it's changed. And also, seeing, you know, we were talking about how the Vatican today, there was reports saying that they're moving away from, you know, saying that gay marriage is evil. Republicans are really distancing themselves from that as a wedge issue. Scott Walker really was hesitant to say that he was going to oppose the ruling. Chris Christie, same thing. So I think, you know, we're really seeing a sea change here.
And the Republicans may be moving away from it as a wedge issue, but Democrats will not.
No.
Because there's still only a handful of Republicans in the Congress and in the House and in the Senate that openly support same-sex marriage. And the Republican National Committee still opposes same-sex marriage. And you can still remember the last two people who won the Iowa caucuses, Mike Huckabee, who opposes same-sex marriage, and Santorum, who really opposes same-sex marriage. So there's a lure for people who want to run for president on the Republican side to, you know, pander to that portion of the party, because those are the people who come out and vote in those early primaries. Ted Cruz, who's a likely senator from Texas, he's a likely 2016 candidate, said, I think he called the Supreme Court ruling a disgrace or something along those lines, and, you know, very much opposes it. And so there's still, you know, many Americans do now live in states like this, but some politicians are still behind the parade on this.
I think it'll be interesting to see if in 2016 we have a Republican candidate who is willing to come out in favor of same-sex marriage. I'm not sure that it... I mean, if you think about it, Obama only came out in favor of it right before the 2012 campaign, which is really amazing to think about that.
And Hillary Clinton
in
2008.
Uh-huh.
She's had a very tough time explaining how that happened. It's still, for her, a very difficult issue.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, DOMA was signed by Bill Clinton, so that's... she's going to have to address.
And Obama didn't evolve on marriage until, you know, Joe Biden opened his mouth. You know, kind of, you know, I said, oh, pushed him down the road there. So
that really released the logjam of a lot of politicians who basically were then catching up to public opinion.
Yeah.
And someone from the audience asks regarding same-sex marriage, why do the courts decide rather than a vote by the people? There actually now have been we're seeing both, right?
Couple states, yeah. But still, I think it was something like 30 states in a row, 35 states in a row that voted down some form of, when it came to the ballot measure, voted down same-sex marriage. And then the last couple of years, there's been a string of about five or six,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Well, North Carolina voted in 2012, and it passed, and then the court ruled this past week that it's unconstitutional. So, you know, sometimes voter hits up against that instead.
I think what you said, John, was true, that in a lot of ways the public was ahead of the politicians, and it became less of an issue. I think the thing that you hear over and over is, I'm against same-sex marriage, but I work with Bob, and he's a great guy, you know? And I think everybody, once you got through the idea and said to yourself, this doesn't affect my life one way or another. If they're married or not married, it's... I don't know what how that's going to ruin my life. And I think the public reached that point, and the politicians just always cautious. We're afraid to make that come out and say that.
Well, we've got a ton of great questions. I really have to thank you. I'm going to try to get back to as many of these as I can after we run through a couple other quick things. Before we leave the Supreme Court issue, though, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been under quite a bit of sustained pressure from some liberals that she should retire while President Obama still has a Democrat-controlled Senate. Presumably, they will get the nomination through more quickly. So, again, assuming it's a GOP Senate victory in November, which seems to be pretty widely expected, how closely are people going to be watching Ruth Bader Ginsburg's health for the next 2 years?
That's terrible to have like a health watch on you. But essentially, she will have one. Yeah. The Republican, if the Republicans are 60% likely to win the Senate, Nate Silver says. And so that will definitely make it difficult for them to get for the Democrats to get any kind of, for Obama to get a nominee through. It's really kind of, it's hard to force a Supreme, this is an appointment for life. And she's still, by all accounts, very sharp. One of the sharpest justices on there. So what are you going to do? Say, hey, lady, get lost. We think you're going to die? It's essentially what they're saying. It's a horrible thing.
And she's so adamant that she's staying, which I admire so much. It's great. She says, I'm not going anywhere. Yeah. I don't care.
Well, it's not like she's unaware about this.
Yeah,
she knows what the deal is. She's made the calculation. That's the way it goes. They appointed her for life. She's staying. That's the thing. So, you can make political calculations for the rest of your life, or you can do what you think is right, and she's obviously made that choice.
Okay. Well, staying on Congress for a little bit, Joe, have the Democrats pretty much thrown in the towel on the Senate control for
this? Nobody's going to say that, but I think, they're trying to figure it out. It'll be interesting to see what happens in California. What's the trickle down here? What does that mean for Barbara Boxer? She's up for re-election in 2 years. And does she stay? She's 74, 75, I think. She's been a little bit slow to raise money. Right now, you should be cranking up the engine. She's been kind of back and forth about her plans. There would be no shortage of people lining up for that seat. I think the person with the inside step on that, it's got to be Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. And I think Tom Steyer, maybe the wealthy environmentalist, former hedge fund guy from San Francisco, might want to get involved in electoral politics, and the Republicans would dredge up some rich person who's never run for office before.
Dredge up sounds a little pejorative.
Dredge up, I know that's maybe well, it's maybe dredge up, yes, draft. Let's see. We'll work on a better word there.
Well, and at some point, Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris are going to have to meet in a dark room somewhere and decide who's running for what. Because we've got the grand dames of politics. We've got Boxer, Pelosi, and Feinstein, and the thinking is they're certainly not getting any younger. And the thinking is at some point they will step away. So certainly, I think those two are Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom are the two front runners for that. And maybe there'll be a leftover for somebody else.
I always think Newsom is better suited for the Senate, where it's a place of a chamber of ideas. Not really responsible for a lot of follow-up.
I was going to say pontificate, but okay.
Pontificate, yes. Where Kamala, she's run a huge bureaucracy now at the Attorney General's office, and it might be better suited towards a governor. I mean, she was in the. There was even a little chatter for her for the Attorney General of the United States recently. So she's definitely on the rise.
Yeah. Yeah. Molly, let's assume the Republicans take the Senate. Mm-hmm. What are they looking forward to doing? I mean, with this newfound control of both houses, will they be able to do anything they can't do now? Mr. Obama presumably will become Mr. Veto, right?
Yeah, well, that's the thing is they're just going to have to put that pressure on Obama. He hasn't had to veto pretty. Like very little. I don't think he's vetoed more than 10, not even that many. I think they're in a really interesting position because they're obviously looking forward to 2016 too. So it's kind of a split. Do you want to be the obstructive Senate and stand firm against Obama and Democrats and send that message to voters? Or do you want to work with Democrats and actually get something done, maybe an immigration bill, you know, maybe work on parts of the Affordable Care Act that Democrats are willing to work on as well? My gut says they go with obstruction. I mean, I think the Ted Cruz wing of the party is pretty strong-willed, and that's a really strong poll for campaigns as well. You know, they want to be able to say that they voted down everything that Obama put up, that they forced him to veto, and they can say, look at all this stuff that we passed that Obama rejected, you know, and put that on him instead of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. One thing we're not seeing much of from President Obama these days is, you know,
President
him out. Yes.
It's President Obama.
Yeah, out on the stumps, you know, trying to pick up the Democratic gubernatorial candidate in Wisconsin or the senatorial candidate down in wherever. He does come out to California, of course. It's a much friendlier polity here. He raises money for his party and for some candidates. But the people we really see out there headlining the Democratic fundraisers and the rallies are two names you might have heard of, Bill and Hillary Clinton. They're new to you? Okay, well, I think you'll be hearing of a lot about from them over the next couple of years. Molly, I mean, this is not just laboring for the party. I mean, this is continuing to lay groundwork for something
right.
else for them,
exactly.
right?
Exactly. And with Obama staying in the shadows a little bit, I think he has his first campaign event on Wednesday with Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy. But he has, that's will be his first rally of the cycle, which is pretty remarkable. But he's, you know, he's not a popular guy in a lot of these states with battleground Senate races. Allison Lundergan Grimes, who's challenging Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, was squirming when they asked her whether or not she voted for Obama. If you watch the video, it is the most uncomfortable thing I've ever seen. And tonight, right before I came here, the debate was on. And they asked her again, and she just won't say. And she had a little bit better answer this time, you know, respect the ballot box, you know, it's a private question. But, you know, she just, she
Even
will do
Neil
anything.
Even admitted voting for
exactly.
Obama.
You know, just to have that sound bite, I voted for Obama, would be toxic for her in her opinion. I don't know that it would be that bad. I mean, I'm sure people voting for her realize, you know, that she probably didn't vote for Mitt Romney. But, you know, that's the sort of calculation that's going on. So Obama's staying in the shadows. Michelle Obama even is staying in the shadows, and she's a popular figure across the board. But the Clintons, you know, they don't have anything to gain by staying in the shadows. They want to be out there. I don't think you could keep Bill Clinton in the shadows if you tried. But, you know, Hillary, you know, she's starting to run, even if she says she hasn't decided. But it's happening.
There's also that meme of that Obama has reached the point where he doesn't like the to and fro anymore. This political thing is messy. It's kind of you know, it's not intellectual. A lot of it is kind of dirty, and Bill Clinton loves that stuff. I mean, he's a happy warrior. He loves going out there and meeting everybody. And there was a thing in the New York Times, I think, on Sunday where they were saying that people like Obama, and Obama in particular, they're kind of turned off by this idea that there's a lot of this that's kind of low down stuff. And Clinton is like, yeah, that's what politics are all about, right? That's what we're doing, aren't we? You know, you hit me, I hit you right back. That's what we're doing. So he is the definition of a political animal, and he's going to try to bring his wife across the finish line.
Okay, well, let's try to get through some more of these questions. And I love this one because it's one I didn't think of, and it, when we were talking about kind of the disruptive technology companies, Airbnb, Uber and such, someone asked, please comment on unlicensed gourmet meal services cutting into restaurant businesses in San Francisco. Have you guys been following any of this?
The food deal, like where they bring you a hot meal?
I believe so, yeah.
Wow.
One of my roommates just ordered that for the first time the other night. I did read that a couple of them actually do pay their employees as employees. They use W-2s, not 1099s, and have benefits for them. So that's a difference.
Well, I don't know. We do it like once a week. Right. We order a meal service. They bring it to your door. They give you instructions on how to just heat it up. You can see the menu online. It's terrific. I hadn't thought about being unlicensed. That's
yeah, me either.
Hope they're washing the chicken and everything, but. But yeah, we use it quite a bit. It's in the city. It's terrific.
A couple questions here about Prop G, which
I'm gonna look at my ballot on that.
Sorry.
What's Prop G?
That's a great question.
What's the second question?
Does anyone off the top of their head know Prop G? Oh, that's the raising the height limits for...
Oh, Pier 7.
Ah, yes.
That's a,
no?
No. 14% to 24% tax if you...
Oh, if you... Oh, it, the anti-flipping. Okay, so this was if you buy a property and it has certain unit numbers, you know, within a certain area, and you sell it within 5 years, you are taxed up to 24%, depending, you know, the longer you hold it, the less you would pay.
Of the selling price.
And this comes out of a kind of anger toward flippers, house flippers, people who are, you know, seen as buying and then kind of jacking up a price of a home and then just kind of profiting from the boom. Any thoughts on this? I mean, talk about topics that are like right in there in San Francisco with the tech boom and the housing shortage and everything else.
This goes to the heart of what a lot of San Franciscans are concerned about, especially longtime folks, middle-income folks, low-income folks who are like, I want some way to grasp, to hold, maintain my grasp on the city right now. And they see in something like this a way to like to do that. And I'd be curious to see how this translates, because it's one way to legislate through the ballot box and do that and put the brakes on it in some way. Now, the thing with stuff like this is the real estate crowd will always figure out a way around this. It may put the brakes on for a couple years, but they'll just like any kind of campaign finance reform, it gets jerry-rigged within a couple of years anyways. I hate to be a cynic, but but that's, you know, but I think this is one of those things that really it really is going to appeal to the heartstrings of a lot of San Franciscans.
Cynicism is kind of a job description for what we do.
I believe that's the deal. Yes.
Everybody's trying to get their calculus right on preserving housing in San Francisco and a diversity of life in San Francisco. And I'm not sure this is it. I'm not sure. We've got the one also where you have to pay a certain amount to, if you have a rental unit and you're going to move your family in, then you have to pay a certain amount, and then that amount has been increased dramatically. And we have the court case where the family was trying to move their daughter into their house so she could help take care of them, and the fee grew from like $6,000 they had to pay them to like $124,000 they had to pay them. 170,000. Well, so I don't think that's the right answer, but we're working to find some way to get a handle on this. But gentrification is marching forward. I'm afraid to tell you.
Before we get to the news quiz, here's a nice question: can you count Gene Kwan out as mayor of Oakland? Why or why not?
As an Oakland resident, let me take a swing at this. No, you can't. Polls are showing her running second right now. I think a lot of that is unnamed recognition because she is the mayor. But you can't, and with ranked choice voting, there's still, you know, not a lot of history of it, and this is the person who won last year by getting a significant portion of the fewer votes than the person who actually got the most in round one. So, but she played the system right. We're going to see who's going to play the system right this time. She's number one is Rebecca Kaplan, and she's again someone who's run citywide a couple of times. She's a member of the city council, and it's a name recognition thing. Neither of these folks have been endorsed by the major newspapers who are following this, and I believe that still counts for something. I think she definitely is still in it. My friends in Oakland. We've had a couple of gatherings where we just sit around, talk to people, and be like, how do I figure out how not to vote for X? How do I vote not to? How can I vote? How can I rig my three choices so Y doesn't win? And it's like, is that what democracy's come down to? Or we were figuring out, like, you have to figure out a formula? Can't you just go in like, I want to vote for this person, and that's it? But now it's like, you know, with ranked choice voting, you get up to three choices. You don't have to take three. You can take up to three. And that's what people are trying to figure out. Who do I not want to put on the ballot, or is it more strategic to put so-and-so number three?
Her lack of popularity is actually helping her because they increased the field. And the bigger the field, the better opportunity you have in ranked choice voting.
Right.
And sitting there at number two, she's in a great spot.
Yeah. It was a brilliant choice to be unpopular.
Yeah, that's what she did.
She was intentionally unpopular to be reelected.
A lot of people wouldn't have played it that way, but it's working
that's
out for
very,
her.
That's a very,
right.
Tricky yeah, very campaign. Tricky.
That was good.
Very okay. Smart. Very smart.
On that note, we're now going to see what you folks know. We're going to move to our news quiz. If Joan, my volunteer, can come up. Those of you who have been here before know how this works, but if you haven't, I know we have a number of newbies here tonight. I'm going to ask a question. That's heavy. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you. Give out your answer nice and loud. And if you have it correct, Joan is going to give you a nice little chocolate treat from Ghirardelli. So, first question. Who said it was, quote, good karma, unquote, for women not to ask for raises? Did you see this story? Sir? No.
Microsoft CEO.
That's right. Joan, gentleman in the blue shirt there. I'm sorry, the person who said it is the CEO of Microsoft for now. I don't know his name off the top of my head. Yeah. Okay, next question. What is the name of the town on the Syria-Turkey border that is being closely contested by ISIS, Kurds, and I saw your name, your hand.
Kobani,
that's right. Another winner right there. What did Senator Elizabeth Warren accuse President Obama of doing during the financial crisis? Did you see this? She was saying he basically picked a side. Ma'am? That's right. He supported Wall Street. You see on the far side? That he supported Wall Street instead of Main Street or the private individuals. Okay. At an international conference in Cairo, donors pledged $5.4 billion for what? In back there, ma'am? That's right, rebuilding Gaza. You see her with a hand up? Okay. 17 people were arrested over the weekend during protests in what city? And your hand shot up, sir. That's right. We'll give it to you. It's a St. Louis area. A further 19 were arrested today. President Obama visited Los Angeles County on Friday to announce the creation of what? You know, raise your hand. Sir? He said it first, so I'm sorry. I'm going to give it to him. Gentleman there in the blue shirt.
How are you going to divide the chocolate?
Yeah, you can share. Sir, put up your hand so she can find you. Here's my favorite one of the week. To whom did actress Gwyneth Paltrow say, quote, you're so handsome that I can't speak properly? Sir? That's right. She said it to the leader of the free world, President Barack Obama. Yes, Michelle feels the same way. Pope Francis kicked off what's called the Extraordinary Synod? I'm not sure how to pronounce that. Of bishops in Rome to discuss what? What are they discussing? Ma'am, your hand. Among other things, yes, it's relationship and sex. Family, relationships, and apparently quite a bit about sex. So we're going to give it to you. You've already got chocolate in your hand, so I don't feel too bad. Okay. President Dilma Rousseff is headed for a runoff election in what country? Sir?
Brazil.
Brazil, that's right. And finally... It's okay, we allow double.
Wow.
We reward news savvy.
For one piece.
You are stingy, sir. We'll give you more afterward. Okay, and finally, what is it that is threatening the world's chocolate supply?
This gentleman in the first row.
Ma'am, Ebola. That is correct. The workforce in Ivory Coast, which is the world's largest producer of cacao, has closed its borders and this is causing a threat. Well, listen, we're going to have more news quiz questions and, of course, much more to discuss on November 3rd at 12 noon here in San Francisco for our next week-to-week political roundtable. Thanks to our panel, Molly Riley, Chuck Medias, and Joe Garofoli. Thanks to all of you here in the audience, listening online, and watching TV. Have a great week.